And now for our first keynote speaker. It is a pleasure to welcome you to the stage. And for this... Oh, yes, hello. We've met before. So nice to see you again. May I say how grateful we are that you will open this conference with a keynote speech.
It's a great pleasure for me to have the opportunity to talk to you on this evening. This is my first lecture in this beautiful building, which I was watching emerging off the ground for the past few years. And this is the most appropriate place to talk about the experience of the two totalitarian regimes. You have heard Jan Karski talking about the message he delivered to President Roosevelt. That was his war against the Nazi Germany. Actually, he almost failed when he was arrested in Slovakia and then given back to Gestapo, and he tried to commit suicide. And fortunately, by a miracle, he was liberated by a group of underground people connected to a socialist leader, Józef Cyrankiewicz. After the war, Jan Karski did not return to Poland. He settled in the United States, and he was a cold warrior because he lectured to American troops overseas about the communist regimes. So possibly he was on the right side during two great wars of the 20th century, the war against Nazi Germany and the Cold War against the Soviet bloc, which was also a war against his home country, Poland, which was a Soviet ally at that time. Actually, I had the strange pleasure to be drafted to the Polish army, still the communist army, so I was trained to kill Americans, possibly many of you too here. So I was on the right side. I was on the wrong side. But coming back to Karski and his experience, the man who saved him, Mr. Cyrankiewicz, became a prime minister of communist Poland, and he acceded in obedience to the communist regime and Joseph Stalin personally. So two people who were close to each other, both were men of the left, both were patriots, both fought against the Nazi Germany, and then one of them worked for the Americans and the other worked for the Soviets. So this is to explain my lectures, to explain shortly a couple of dilemmas that Polish leaders faced during this difficult period. Beginning in a relatively quiet time, this is Europe in the interwar period. You see Poland with a slightly different borders than it has today, but nevertheless between the big green Soviet Union and somehow smaller Germany, not yet Nazi Germany. So it was a difficult position because for the previous 120 years, Poland did not exist because of this difficult neighborhood, two powerful neighbors, Germany and Russia, and Austria, which disappeared as a big power after the First World War. So being in between, even if it was a state, was precarious. This is the map of Europe before 1914, before the Great War. There is no Poland. So people who lived in the interwar period, people who grew up in interwar Poland, had a strong feeling that this is a fragile state and this is a dangerous place. However, it turned out that being between Russia and Germany was relatively easy before these two gentlemen raised to power. And Adolf Hitler became the Chancellor of Germany and then the Führer, the leader of Nazi Germany, in 1933, Josef Vissarionovich Stalin became the head of the Communist Party of the Bolshevik Party of Russia, then the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, about a decade before, but he consolidated his power and began to transform his country only in the early 1930s, almost parallelly to Adolf Hitler. So Polish leaders could watch two great neighbors transforming into a new kind of state, not just dictatorships, not just tyrannies, but countries with a kind of regime that had not been seen in human history before. Some political scientists and historians call them totalitarian regimes to stress the similarity, because the Nazis and the communists hated each other, and they were enemies. And nevertheless, we see a number of similarities between the two regimes, similarities which inhabitants of Poland could experience themselves. They could make comparative research in the nature of totalitarian regimes themselves, including Jan Karski. Here I gave a few features of these regimes. The first three, most of the political scientists agree that this is something which is differentia specifica, which distinguishes totalitarian regime from other kind of dictatorships. Because for most of human history, most of the governments were dictatorial or monarchies. Living in a democratic country, having human rights and civic rights, it's a novelty. And up to recently, only a small minority of the global population could enjoy it. But the Nazi regime in Germany and the Soviet regime, which continued the great Russian imperial tradition, were different. They were not only dictatorial. The first feature which you see is ideology. And I added a Greek term, gnosis. Gnosis in Greek means knowledge. And it also refers to an early Christian heretical group, a group which believed that knowledge can save you. And this is the difference between ideology like liberalism or social democratic ideology and the Marxist-Leninism of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union or the National Socialism of the Adolf Hitler's party. Their ideology offered an explanation to everything. It also promised a perfect world of justice and the right order, be it based on class or on race. So it wasn't an ideology like you may know. It was something different. Moreover, it promised salvation. It was to promise something which exceeds this world. This is why it has such incredible power, motivating power. People who believed in these ideologies were fanatics. But I don't mean to make it pejorative. They so much believed in their ideology that they were ready to die and they were ready to kill, many of them. Well, some of them, of course, were opportunists, but many of them were completely devoted to the cause. And they wanted to transform the world, not just their countries. Both ideologies had global, universal ambitions. So if one of them won one of these wars, we wouldn't have, well, we would probably all, most of us, be dead here. But if we were still alive, we would have been subjects of powerful global revolutionary regimes. The second feature is monocentric organization. What does it mean? You have one center of power. There is a dictator or a small group, collective dictator, which rules everything, and there are no limits to their rule. There is no organization which is not subordinate to the ruling party, and the ruling party is subordinate to the leader or the group of leaders. And the third feature is political mobilization of the masses. As I said, there were many dictatorships in history, but the probably key difference between the totalitarian regimes and the others is that they don't just want obedience. No, they want enthusiasm. They want the citizens, or rather subjects, because citizens in these countries have unlimited rights, to participate. These are participatory dictatorships. You don't have much say, but you are to implement what they say, and you are to believe it and be enthusiastic. So a peculiar combination of enthusiasm and fear, this is the two emotions that gave this ideology a human power, the ability to act through millions of people, because it was not Adolf Hitler who committed the Holocaust. He was a single man. It was not Joseph Stalin who was running the Gulag labor camps. No. These were thousands and millions of people who followed the leadership. Then you have a few more features, and here political scientists disagree, are they necessary or not, I list them. Single mass party. Again, mass party, this is something modern. There had been no mass parties before late 19th century, and single one, without opposition. You cannot oppose it. System of terror. You cannot oppose the ruling party because you may die, you may be arrested without any trial. You may just disappear. And this is systematic. Terror had been the favorite sport of tyrants through history. But the system of terror is something different. It means no one is safe. Maybe the dictator himself, but even his closest friends are not safe. Actually, in the Soviet Union, a large part of the victims of the Stalinist terror were old Bolsheviks. They were overrepresented among the people executed or sent to the camps. Then you have monopoly of information, which means you cannot convey any message through such means as press, radio, television, when it came to being, without the approval of the rulers. Actually, you cannot even talk about it, because that may be a crime. I've gone through a number of trials of people who just said a political joke to a single person, and it cost them 2 years of a labor camp. So that may be very dangerous. And finally, control of the economy. And you know very well that the communist regimes are different to other regimes because they nationalize, they etatize all the economy. All the assets are state-owned. But the Nazi regime, especially during the Second World War, also largely controlled the economy. It retained private property, private business, but controlled it, as many governments do during the war. So the best sentence which explains the nature of the totalitarian state is this quotation from not a communist, but an Italian fascist, Benito Mussolini, the leader of the fascist party. Everything within the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. The state which is total. You live in a country, you live within the state, and there is nothing outside. There is no private sphere where you can hide in. So it was most unlikely that Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union could cooperate because they really hated each other, and they loudly proclaimed that their major aim is to destroy the fascists or the communists respectively. Actually, they mobilized many people in many countries into this war, presenting themselves as the only available power capable of stopping this brown or red enemy. So what a surprise. This photograph comes from Moscow, August 23, 1939, and the German Foreign Affairs Minister and the Soviet Foreign Affairs Minister signed a non-aggression treaty, a treaty of cooperation between the two countries. That was the opening of war, because the treaty had a secret clause. You can see Mr. Stalin standing behind. The treaty had a secret clause which divided Poland and actually all of Central and Eastern Europe between the Black and the Baltic Sea into two spheres of influence. So you see the map on Poland, and Poland divided into the German occupation on the left and the Soviet occupation on the right. The green line was the original line of division, which they defined in Moscow in August. In practice, during the war, because Soviet Union joined the war later than it promised, the final border was the blue line. But the green line means that the Warsaw would have been divided, very much like Berlin. Originally, this part of Warsaw on the other side of the river was to be Soviet property. And this part of the Warsaw where we are was to be a German property. So if they actually did what they had agreed on and things went on differently, we would have been in Warsaw, a German state at the peripheries of the German Empire. That led to something more than an exercise of political thinking. Because in the interwar period, when Stalin made Soviet Union an industrial power and a military power after devastating civil war in the early 1920s, and Hitler remade Germany a major European industrial and military power, Polish leaders had a difficult choice. Can we live in between them? Should we join Hitler and go against the Soviets, or should we join the Soviets, go against Hitler? Actually, both parties offered alliances. Hitler was kind to promise to Poland all of Ukraine, down to the Black Sea. Fortunately, as one of our diplomats said, that cooperation with Germany would end with us, he said to his minister, Minister Josef Beck, that eventually will end taking care of German cows in the Ural Mountains. That this is a transitory, temporary offer of Germans up to the moment when we jointly defeat Soviet Union. And then they will do what they were talking about for a long time. Adolf Hitler was proud to be racist. And he was outspoken in his racism. In his main book, Mein Kampf, he was very clear about it. That not only Jews were anti-racist, Jews were not human beings from his point of view. But the Slavic people, Poles, Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, were the Untermensch, subhumans, who don't deserve to rule themselves. They can only be ruled by a superior race, the Nordic Aryans, the Germans. So Poland had a political dilemma up to 1939, up to this agreement between Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. But then, since the double occupation of Poland, everyone in Poland faced a dilemma. What to do? Because it's not just about politics. It's about, for example, registering with an office. Are you going to hide? Are you afraid? Have you been active before the war in a political party? Were you outspoken against Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union? Because if you were, you are under threat. Gestapo or NKVD is after you. Are we to oppose the occupiers? Collaborate? Evade? Avoid? There are many options. It's an oversimplification to believe that you have just two options. Resist, fight, or accommodate and cooperate. No, actually, most of the people try to evade, to avoid them, keep low profile. And in the bad times, hard times, choices are difficult. Because you're hungry, you're insecure, your children are hungry, you have no place to live, so you first think about your own problems. What are we going to eat tomorrow? And only then you think about what's the future of my country or what's the future of my neighbor. Who cares about neighbors? Well, some people do care. You have seen Jankarski caring. So choices were difficult, and they became political. What was existential? What was a matter of daily life became a political problem. For example, imagine that you look from your window and you see someone running away and the Gestapo is after him or a German policeman. Would you open your door? Would you risk your life? Would you risk your family life? Your parents, your children, your sister, your brother? For an unknown man? It's a difficult question. Should you expect from someone to be a hero? Risk life for an unknown person who may be just a thief? Would you risk your life to open door to a hiding Jew? Because that was a risk of life. For any assistance offered to the Jews, there was the death penalty. And sometimes, quite very often, it was a collective responsibility. That means German police or gendarmerie was killing all the families and burning the house or killing the neighbors. So it's not just your personal moral decision to do something right. No. And your neighbors may don't like you because you're attracting death when you help someone. Okay? If you want to help someone, do it yourself far away from us. These are basic moral dilemmas. This is why it's so difficult to judge these people. And I try to refrain from it as long as I can. Finally, how long will it last? Here you have the first less than 2 years of war, from September 1939 to June 22nd, 1941, the period of the Soviet-German cooperation, which ended. And then Germany expanded eastward and controlled most of Europe, as you see. This is the United Europe of Adolf Hitler. Okay? It's actually even bigger than the European Union today. It was one of the European integration projects, but on a very particular terms. And the question is, will it last? And of course, the Nazis were saying it will. This is a 1,000 years Reich. It will last 1,000 years, read forever, which means you don't have much choice. You accept it or you die. It's completely irrational to resist it. So rationality, actually, was in service of the great powers because they were mighty. So each person alone, making the decision to resist was irrational. Making the decision to behave morally, from our point of view, and offer assistance to someone running away was irrational. Rationality acted against morality, And morality acted against rationality, against your own survival, your family's survival, your neighbor's survival. And actually, if Nazis were not racist, they could have behaved more rationally. They didn't ask Poles for collaboration. They so much despised the Slavic population of Poland and the Jewish population. So they didn't care about anyone who wanted to cooperate. No, there were not so many such people. No national leader was ready to cooperate with Germany. So Germans started to think about potential Polish cooperation when it was too late, in late 1943, 1944, when so much blood they had spoiled. So it was too late to ask for cooperation. The Soviets, in the early period of the occupation, they wanted cooperation. They had nothing against the Poles, nothing against Ukrainians, Belarusians, and the Jews. They just wanted to make everyone a Soviet man. Speaking Polish or Ukrainian or Yiddish, didn't matter. Just in a different way of thinking. The Pierekovka duszy, to remold the soul, to make them think differently. Actually, the name of the Gulag labor camps were educational camps. That was for re-education, to make you a good Soviet citizen, and sometimes quite effective. I personally met a man who passed through the Gulag, and up to 1995, he still admired Joseph Stalin as a great leader. So this is not invented, this is possible. So it seemed to last forever, but it didn't. It ended in ruins. This is my hometown, this city, Warsaw, 1945. Actually, at the bottom left, this is the place where you are, the former ghetto, the Sea of Ruins. That was the end of the 1,000-year-long German Reich in Poland. And then what happened? The Soviet army came back and liberated this country. Well, today we talk quite often that that was the second occupation. Well, formally it was. When you have a foreign army coming and without legal basis occupying your territory, this occupation. But you cannot tell it to a concentration camp prisoner. He or she was liberated. Soviet army did liberate many people from mortal threat. Because the intensity of killing, especially in the late years of the German occupation, was incredible. Soviets did kill a lot of people, torture, imprison, deport. But when you compare the death rates of the Nazis and death rates of the Soviets, these are incomparable. Actually, there is another difference. Nazi Germany preferred to kill aliens, not Germans. Relatively few Germans, ethnic Germans, I mean, I exclude German Jews, were victims of the Nazi regime. 90-something percent of them were foreigners, Slavs, East European Jews, and other people. The Soviet regime mostly persecuted its own citizens. That made a difference. This is what happened to Poland after the war. So that was the liberation. Liberation meant that Poland was moved about 200 kilometers westward. You see the territories lost to the Soviet Union. You see the territories annexed from Germany. This is what President Roosevelt promised to Jan Karski. Actually, he promised only a part of East Prussia. But he promised something else. This country will never fail you, which was not completely accurate, so to speak. But that was not a matter of choice. There were 12 million Soviet troops in Central Europe. No one could change it. No one could challenge the Soviet Union in Central Europe. It was not just about the Yalta Agreement between Great Britain, Soviet Union, and the United States. It was about facts. No one could change. So the fate of Poland was sealed. And actually, Jan Karski was on the safe side, being abroad. He didn't have to make choices which Poles had to make again. What should we do? Oppose? Resist? Cooperate? After all, the Soviets did not incorporate Poland into the Soviet Union. No. They left Poland as a separate, officially sovereign country. They just imposed a new kind of a regime, communist regime, which was introduced by Polish communists, with some Soviet help, of course. But principally, everyone was invited to join and be enthusiastic. And those who were not enthusiastic were forced to be enthusiastic. At least that was the plan. This is the Cold War Europe. So the fate of Poland is not unique. It's maybe unique in this comparative study of Nazi and communist regime, but also Ukraine, Belarus, Baltic states had both German and Soviet occupation, sometimes in line, sometimes parallel. So this is not unique. Countries of Southeastern Europe were, during the war, mostly allies of Nazi Germany, and only then became the communist countries. Nevertheless, there is a certain commonality of experience over there, and also commonality of choices. You live in a country which has a totalitarian regime, which want more than your obedience. More than obedience is needed. You must love it. You must support it. You must vote for it. In all communist dictatorships, every 2 or 3 or 4 years, there were elections with a single party, of course. So what for? Just to make sure you are obedient and you go and you vote for the single party. It's like psychotherapy. You repeat it several times and you then start believing. And you also see other people going and voting. So everybody else, if everybody else goes, votes for the party, maybe I should not be strange and crazy and irrational and nonconformist and avoid it. It's a very powerful mechanism, not just terror, but the fact that others do the same, or they appear doing the same. It was like a big theater, because millions of people didn't like the regime. They wanted to oppose it, but they were afraid or just opportunistic not to express, to show that they disagree. And they made the impression that everybody, or almost everybody, was for. And there was one more aspect to this. This is the Soviet bloc, circa 1960. I know it's 1960 because you can still see China as a part of the Soviet bloc. But what I'm going to show you, it's so powerful. It's so great. It will last 1,000 years. So your choice, your freedom, is to acknowledge the necessity if you live there. A necessity is to adopt, okay, conform, because resistance doesn't make it. It's irrational. So again, sometimes being brave and moral was irrational. It's not a good choice, actually. You would like to have rationality and morality on one side, but sometimes it's not. The wisdom of both the German occupation and then the communist period afterwards was keep low profile if you don't want to have trouble. And if you want to make career, be enthusiastic. Show it. So those who supported the regime were very visible because they wanted to show it. Those who opposed the regime were invisible because they were afraid of attracting security police and persecution. And social life is like a theater. We perform. I'm performing for you, and you, in a sense, perform to listen to me. Right? Thank you. So I have a feeling that you are listening to me now. So now imagine that all of you rise and start shouting, "Long life, Comrade Stalin." And I would think, oh my God, all of them love Comrade Stalin. And I would join you probably. Really? Do you think you are different? Do you really think you would behave differently than people did behave during these difficult times? Do you think you are better? No. Statistically, not. But statistics doesn't say anything about the individual. The fact that there were people like Jan Karski, they were probably margins, bigger or smaller. Hopefully bigger than the margins of the villains, of those who found pleasure in cruelty and killing. But these were margins. And in between, you have this mass of the people who just were trying to survive this way or another, using this strategy or another. These are difficult choices. Don't assume that you would have been a hero. Okay? Statistical analysis doesn't say so. We are different because we have different ideas, we have different attitudes. We have different weaknesses, right? But maybe the choices we are facing today, such as being indifferent toward millions of hungry people in many countries, is equally horrible choice. We are not terrorized by anyone. We could have done something more than we have. Each of us, even those who have done something important. So this is not to judge you, or I'm judging myself actually, not you. But to make you understand the difficult positions and the choices these people made. in horrible times, and especially at a time when it was very unlikely that a good day will ever come. Karski was lucky enough to live up to the 1990s and see Poland again free, sovereign, and democratic. But many people were not. And a lesson from this. First, if you want to stop evil, do it early. Adolf Hitler was just an unsuccessful painter, and then a not very successful leader of a small radical party in southern Germany. Okay. Joseph Stalin was one of many potential successors of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, one of several of them. Maybe if Trotsky won the intra-party struggle, he could have been equally cruel. We don't know it. But certainly Stalin was not a god of the Soviet Union in 1925. He was just a man. Second, sometimes there are no good choices. Many of you may be leaders in the future. Actually, you are on the right path to become leaders. And one day you may be in position of the Polish foreign affairs minister in 1930s. Should I go with Russia against Germany or with Germany against Russia? And he made the decision to go with Great Britain and France against everybody else. And, you know, he died in exile as a man who lost his country. However, don't believe those who say that this is eternal, what you face. Nothing is eternal. Even time is just temporary. The 1,000-year-long Third Reich of Adolf Hitler lasted just 12 years. The communist regimes, which were to take the globe, remade humanity, lasted a few generations, in Poland, 45 years only. Okay, enough for Jan Karski to see the end, to see the beginning and to see the end. So don't trust them. And don't get hypnotized by the sheer size of them. Because everything was forever until it was no more. No one believed it may end soon up to it has actually happened. So this is Poland in EU and NATO. I don't expect Mr. Hitler or Mr. Stalin to ever thought about it. And I think this is my personal way to win a war against them, posthumously. Finally, about the totalitarian regimes and dictatorships. Totalitarian regimes are always fragmentary. There is a misleading name to it. Total means overwhelming. But if it really was overwhelming, Jan Karski would have been unable to do what he did. Even in the Auschwitz concentration camp, there was an underground illegal organization. Okay? If you can make it in a concentration camp of Nazi Germany in Auschwitz, you can make it everywhere. Okay? I cannot imagine worse conditions for running illegal underground activity than the Auschwitz concentration camp. So there is no regime, and there will be no regime ever, which cannot be resisted. So the Second World War was a night, a very dark night. But against this dark background, we can see the stars, people like Jan Karski, who shine and who prove something. Yes, you can do it. You are 24, you are a young officer of the Polish army, you have nothing, you don't have even a weapon. Right? You have just some poison to kill yourself, not to reveal your secrets. This is your only weapon and your courage. Okay? He lost the war to save the Jews, but he lived long enough to see his country free again. So there is some happy end to at least his story. I don't want to talk much longer because Monika told me that you are the people who like asking questions. And I love questions. Actually, I'm addicted to questions. If I don't hear a question, I feel bad. My hands tremble. So you're more than welcome to ask me questions about Polish history or the totalitarian regimes. And thank you for your attention.
was it about Jan Karski that allowed him to...
I thought for sure my voice would be loud enough without it. I apologize. So what was it about Jan Karski that allowed him to be such a shining star in the darkest night?
Difficult question. If I had a receipt for becoming a hero, we would have cloned many Jan Karskis. Now it's a very complex process. Actually, he was a man of strong convictions. He was a Christian and a man of the left. He was a socialist. Actually, there was a study about the chances for survival in extreme conditions like concentration camps. Believers were stronger. Christians, Jews, or people who believed in Joseph Stalin. Just the act of believing makes you stronger because you have an external point of reference outside of the camp. The world is not reduced to the place where you are. Well, this is one of the keys, but there are many of them. He grew up in interwar Poland, and that was a strange place because of this fragility, this precarious situation. School, state, military service, university, and the family, especially educated families, were teaching young people into patriotism and remaining faithful. That was the virtue. Be loyal. So this is not a receipt. This is my small key. And there is something else. Jan Karski was sensitive. He was extremely perceptive. This is why he was chosen as a secret courier. He could easily memorize plenty of detail, which means he saw the details. He could watch. He had the skill of seeing, which is not quite common, and listening to people. So he, after many years afterwards, he can quote verbatim what people told to him. He was like a tape recorder. He was a messenger, a living letter to transmit messages, mostly from Polish underground political parties to the government in exile, but also from the Jewish leaders. So he recorded the message, brought it abroad, and maybe this attention to detail is useful as a shield against being misled by a great speaker. Adolf Hitler was a great speaker, after all. Many smart German people were misled by him. So maybe there is something in this. I like it as a historian. History has always a place and a time, and it has details. And when you see details clearly, you can understand it much better than you try to see the generalities only. Maybe it's not the best answer for your question, but that's all what I can say about it. Yes, please.
Hello, thank you for coming to speaking. I'm Edward Christmas, I'm from France. You talked about the history of Poland, and I was more curious about what you thought these events changed in the mentality of the Polish and the future, and how it would have shaped the future of the Polish mentality, culture, and politics, or whatever. Thank you.
It's a great question. Actually, I hope you have additional 2 hours to listen to my answer. It was a disaster, it was apocalyptic, it was the end of the world. I'm not metaphoric, because the world of Warsaw Jewry disappeared. The German city of Breslau is no longer, it's a Polish city of Wrocław. The Polish city of Vilno is now the Lithuanian Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, and there are a few Poles left. So there were worlds which disappeared forever, probably. Some worlds resurrected, and this is the city of Warsaw. At the end of war, before the war, Warsaw had 1.4 million inhabitants. In 1945, it had 140,000 inhabitants, 10% of the population. The rest was half dead, half deported. So this place was no longer. And it's back there. How does it change your mentality? In many ways. For example, I have a strange feeling of fragility of the world. The world is fragile. More fragile than you believe. States are fragile. Markets are fragile. Cultures, nations. Actually, abstractions are more persistent because you cannot crush them. You can crush a city. You can kill a million people. But, for example, legal title to the land remains. It's abstraction. It's not a book. It's a title. It remains. What else? When you emerge out of apocalyptic event, the end of the world, you think really differently. So, for example, Soviet army was welcomed by most of the Poles after their experience of the German occupation. It wouldn't have been welcomed in 1939 because it was horrible. Even Jews were escaping from the Soviet zone of occupation and to the German zone of occupation because they believed this is the worst thing that can happen to you, to be a Soviet citizen. Okay, they were wrong. So I don't mean to make you relativist, rather the opposite. But it's changing your understanding of how solid the world is. It's less solid than you suppose. Also, it's somehow hidden in our biographies. I will give you an example. I like to have spur 12 liters of milk, 5 kilos of flour, 3 kilos of sugar, and some salt at home. Why? Because my father did the same. Why he did? Because during the war he was hungry. And I learned from my parents, always have some reserves. Always. It's completely crazy. I don't need it. I can call. I can go to an online shop to order some sugar in the middle of the night. But I keep it. It's within me. And I haven't lived through any war. It's been more than a generation before me, and it's still somewhere here. It's not just an empty land which is a consequence of destruction. Why do you have the financial center of Warsaw in this part of the city, some a kilometer from here? Because that was the ghetto. It was destroyed. So up to the 1990s, there were a lot of empty lots to build new towers. So these are material consequences of destruction, but there are these hidden consequences. Not very much visible, but sometimes, for example, in extremely emotional discussions of the Poles about the past. So emotional. I still remember an academic seminar when we were discussing the book of Jan Tomasz Gross on Jedwabne murder, on killing of the Jews by the Polish neighbors in 1941. And there were professors of history mostly, and half of the people were crying. So there are many ways in which the war is a contemporary history, I mean a history which is present. There are many ways in which the communist regime is still present, subtle ways. I suppose that, you know, my training as a soldier of the Polish Communist Army is maybe still a part of myself, at least the understanding that people will do everything to get a bottle of vodka in the evening of Saturday. You know, that was the main problem of the company. So I have given you a couple of very disparate consequences, especially of this joint experience, consecutive and joint experience of the Nazi and communist regimes, just to show you how diverse they may be. But Poland is not unique. Actually, millions and billions of people in the 20th century had lived under cruel regimes. Now, comparing to China during the Great Leap Forward in the late 1950s, Poland was a nice place. Maybe not during the Second World War, but Poland of the 1950s was a nice, sunny, comfortable place compared to China in the 1950s. And that was 600 million people, of whom at least 40 million died out of hunger. So don't treat the story as something unique, from horrible event from a distant history in an exotic place. No. I would say that in many countries this is a part of the family narratives. Maybe not two totalitarian regimes, but some horrible events of the past. Yes, please. Mm-hmm. The microphone is coming.
Thank you for sharing about the personal narratives and this nostalgia and the cultural nuances of history manifesting itself. And so my question's a little bit more about this phenomena. I was wondering if this nostalgia for a central state has affected contemporary policies, not only in Poland, but also in territories that were also governed by Soviet Russia, and how this affects minority rights and inclusion for communities in the state. Thank you.
There are contradictory consequences. One is the rejection, because the communist regime had its best day gone many years before it collapsed in Poland. Actually, this is why Poland was the leader in the implosion of the communist regimes in Europe in 1989. Its good days had been gone. So a few Poles wanted it to stay, including members of the Communist Party, actually. So many features of new democratic Poland were most welcome exactly because they were different than the previous regime. However, there is another aspect, layer of it, what you got used to certain uniformity, to certain equality, egalitarianism. And you may disagree, dislike, or just not understand what these strange people are doing. I remember older members of my family. I have a lot of family in the countryside, farmers, were completely lost in the 1990s. They could not understand what was going on. What were the rules of the game, especially market? How is it? Why I cannot sell my product? Why the price is like this? What these strange people on TV are doing? They were asking me questions which I couldn't answer in 5 minutes. But I understood that they were lost. There was plenty of confusion. So the question is, what may emerge out of confusion? And as you see, largely, it's a success story. Well, I give you an example of probably the, especially in the context of the history of the Second World War. Since 1980s, Polish sociologists were making research on public attitudes toward various nations. And historically, Germans were not the most favorite group. They were actually at the bottom. And what happened between 1988 and the present? You see dislike towards the Germans declining. And not even not sympathy, but understanding, treating them like other people, our neighbors, growing up. Just incredible. I couldn't believe it. So, and there was a lot of pressure. My grandmother hated Germans. Okay? She was watching her brother dying slowly after being tortured by Gestapo. Okay? And I didn't even try to change her mind. That was too late. And she had a basis to make it. Okay? I didn't share her emotions. So in a country, after such experience, if you can change this. Now Germany is an interesting, attractive country right across the river. If it's not so much a border. It's a river, you can easily cross it. So among my students, I don't see it at all. I'm not sure to what extent I answer your question. What remains, and I'm afraid that may be common to many people who had lived under communist regimes, and maybe their children too, is an understanding that the state may solve the problems. Certain etatist approach. The state is powerful, we have a problem, let's make a ministry. We have a problem with toleration, let's make a minister of toleration. Or we have a problem with the past, let's make the National Institute of Memory, like this. I don't share it. I rather believe we have a lot of problems, but the better way to tackle them is by civic action, not by ministerial action. Sorry, it would have taken me another 2 hours to keep answering your question. Oh, yes, and I reportedly I have to stop. Thank you very much for your questions. Thank you very much for your attention.